The following is a point of view program. Opinions expressed are those of the participants.
One of every three bites of food has been pollinated by pollinators, birds, bees, bats, other animals. Then beyond that, it's all of the flowers in the world are pollinated by these animals.
Good evening. This is In Other Words Radio, produced by women and made in Montana, and I'm Amy Sullenberg. At In Other Words, we obviously like words and plays on words. Last fall, I produced a show entitled In Other Birds. We've also had a show called In Other Turds, that was fun, and have In Other Curds, that's cheese, in the works. You can find any of our past shows at inotherwordsradio.com. Now, tonight's show is a follow-up to the first In Other Birds show, and we're going to talk pollinators. Stay with us for an hour of In Other Birds, bees, butterflies, and more. In the first half, I speak with Sue Real, naturalist and educator from Missoula, about our native bees and other pollinators. And then bring on my colleague at Montana Audubon, Amy Seaman, to talk cool birds, followed by an interview that Amy conducted with the scientist Jeff Pippin about butterflies. And we sneak in a bit on hummingbirds, the wonderful avian pollinators here in Montana. Stay with us on In Other Words. This is Amy Sullenberg, and I am here speaking with Sue Real for In Other Words Radio. And we are going to start this show talking about pollinators. And Sue, he lives here in Missoula, Montana, and I'm just going to let her jump right in. And mostly, I'm first curious, why did you get interested in pollinators?
Well, good question. For years and years, I've been a bird watcher and have traveled a bit around the world and also watched birds in my own backyard. And through that watching birds, I started getting interested in other animals and insects in particular, since they're relatively easy to watch. And so I started with butterflies, and then eventually through my work, I needed to learn more about pollination and pollinators. So I started to study bees, and I love to have a subject that I can actually get into. And so I knew nothing about native bees, and it's been what I've been doing for the last couple of years.
Great. So maybe before we dive into the fascinating world of pollinators, what is it that you do for work here in Missoula?
Well, I have a wonderful job at the Forest Service. I work for the Lolo National Forest as a wildlife educator and interpreter. So I spend my time going into classrooms, teaching teachers, doing brochures like the ones we're going to talk about today, interpretive signage all about wildlife, and ecosystem services, which is given me an opportunity to learn a lot about nature, which I love to share with other people.
Great. And I know you've been doing that for a long time in our community. Maybe you can talk about that in a little bit, but I think we should just dive in. I've been really interested in pollinators like you. Going from bird watching to realizing that birds are big pollinators, but so are so many other things. But maybe you could just enlighten us a bit. What is a pollinator and why do we care?
Well, first, it's important to figure out what pollination is. Pollination is actually a pretty simple process. All of our flowering plants need to get their pollen from one of their flowers to another. And surprisingly, most of the pollinators, or the way pollination occurs with flowering plants, is by animals. Of course, there are some wind pollinator plants, like, for example, pine tree. When we have all this pollen in the springtime, it's from pine trees setting out their pollen. But with most of the flowering plants and our food plants, it's little grains of pollen that need to go from one pea plant to another pea plant of the same species. And this is done by something like a bumblebee.
People have been probably watching bees and they know forever, and they know that insects pollinate. But why is that so crucial to sort of functioning ecosystem and that ecosystem services that you mentioned?
Well, human-centrically, we depend on pollinators to pollinate our foods. So one of every three bites of food has been pollinated by pollinators, birds, bees, bats, other animals. So that's really important, and people kind of don't think about what those plants might be, but you can name every fruit and vegetable out there, and it's pollinated by animal pollinators. Then beyond that, it's all of the flowers in the world are pollinated by these animals, and they're doing it. They're not hired to do this, of course. They're doing this because they are getting something back from the flowers that are enticing them with pollen. They eat the pollen, and they eat the nectar that the flowers have. So it's a great mutual relationship, this plant-pollinator interaction that's going on there. And humans benefit greatly by it, but so does the rest of the world. It's a critical component because without pollination, we don't have the seeds set. Sometimes we don't get the fruit production or the vegetable production, and we don't have the great diversity of plants out there without pollination.
So you mentioned that pollination happens from all these animals, particularly birds, bees, and bats. So maybe we could do a bit on birds, spend a whole bunch of time on bees, because I know that's your area of interest, and we've got these great guides, and we can talk about those, and maybe a little bit about bats at the end. So when I think of birds and pollination, I think of, in Montana anyway, I think about hummingbirds. Am I missing anything, or are hummingbirds where it's at?
Pretty much it's hummingbirds here in western Montana, most of the northern part of the U.S. It's hummingbirds pollinating certain kinds of flowers. They are a little more general than some of the bees, but they do have special flowers that they're particularly looking for, and we can talk a little bit about that. Because if you look at a hummingbird, you can notice that, of course, it can hover, which makes it a great mechanism for it to actually reach into flowers, right, as a bird, and not many birds can do that. And then also it has a long bill, and that long bill fits in perfectly to longer tubular flowers that we see out there, like penstemon or some of the scarlet gilia and trumpet flower vines. And so when you look out in the world around you and you see really long tubular flowers, you can bet that it's a hummingbird that's one of the major animal pollinators for that plant. So they actually, when they put that bill in that flower, the pollen sprinkles on their bill and gets spread on their forehead, and then the hummingbird will go somewhere else. Other birds around here, it's not so common. I know in Arizona, other places that have a lot of doves, white-winged doves are important pollinators there, from cactuses and other plants.
Okay, so that's birds, hummingbirds. A little later in this conversation, maybe we can talk about what you can do and some of the threats to some of these critters, but let's go from birds here in Montana over to bees. And I would love to hear a little bit more about the diversity and interesting bees that we have around, because there's more to the story than just honeybees.
Very much so. Most of us are knowledgeable about honeybees, and they do a great service. But even more so, we have hundreds of species or thousands of species of native bees here across the country in Montana too. And so they're kind of unsung heroes of the pollination world, and there are species we don't even know yet their names, because it's kind of one of those sciences that hasn't had a lot of study. So we've got a researcher on the Helena National Forest that's actually discovering new species. So there's a kind of two groups of bees that are important in pollination, and that's social bees like the bumblebee, which is similar to what the honeybee is. They're both social bees, and the bumblebee actually has a system of worker bees and the queen, and they are very hardworking pollinators. They're big and beautiful. I think they're my favorite, and they are able to be out early in the morning and late at night, and they actually do a lot of work. And what we're finding is that our wild bees probably can produce twice as much pollination services as honeybees, which is good for us, because as we have these declines in honeybees, we're finding that the wild population of other pollinator bees is incredibly important to us. And that's interesting in that you can't really just have a monoculture. We really need high diversity of flowers to be able to keep good populations of our wild, diverse native bee population. And then there's another group. There's this huge group of solitary bees that are smaller than the bumblebee and are all the little guys that you see flitting around your sunflowers or any of your other plants in your garden. And they, most of them, 80%, nest in the ground, which makes it real important that you're careful with mulch and harvesting so that you don't disturb these little bee colonies underground. We don't always think about that. They also like old wood, and they use holes made by beetles in trees. So there are really many, many, many different species of solitary bees that are really important. One in particular I might mention is the mason bee, which is being used now. This wild bee is actually raised to pollinate fruit trees. It's a really critically important little solitary bee that we use domestically to do this pollination services, because they're out in the spring, right when all of our beautiful cherry and apple and other orchard trees are looking for pollination.
Yeah, I've seen recently it seems to be all these people making little mason bee houses and just solitary bee houses where they drill holes in wood and just stick them up around, and then you can actually watch larvae develop. And then it seems like a pretty neat way to encourage bees, both encourage them in your garden and your yard, but also be able to see who's about.
Yeah, one of the things that attracts me to bees and insects is they're really great animals to watch, and we can get really close. I use them quite a bit in my role as an educator with young people in classrooms in the field, because you can watch the bees do their work. You can watch them build their little cocoons and emerge, and almost some of these you can actually handle, because solitary bees are, they sting, but it's like barely a prick, of course, because their stinger is so small. And most of these native bees try not to sting you unless you're squeezing them. That's not part of their method of life. But one thing I do want to mention while I'm talking about stinging is people really confuse things like wasps, yellow jackets, and bees, and they're different animals altogether. We have problems with yellow jackets, especially this time of year as we head to the fall. And I totally understand people trying to, or fearful of it, but they're more aggressive at the end of their life, the yellow jackets. But the honeybees, and certainly if you are disturbing a hive, but the wild bees are relatively harmless and fun to watch because of that.
So one thing I've noticed when I've been watching bees about is I'll watch a bee for a while and then I'll realize that is not a bee, that is a fly. And I wonder, maybe we should be talking about birds, bees, flies, and bats if we're talking about pollination. So is there easy ways to tell the difference between a bee and one of those flies that looks a lot like a bee?
Yes, there is a way to tell easily, and I'll go one step further and I'll put wasps, bees, and flies. And actually, they all have the ability and do pollinate other plants. They're just not quite the workhorse that a bee is, because bees have hairs on their body that actually attracts and collects pollen. Whereas, let's take a wasp. So here's your black and yellow, and many of these bee wasps are black and yellow, but bumblebees have hairs. All the wild bees, native bees, mostly have hairs on their bodies. And wasps don't. If you ever looked closely to a wasp, it's kind of like armor. It's very hard-shelled. So it's not the color. It's actually looking for hairs on the body. And then if you get to look closely to a wasp, it has a tiny waist. So that's a real big key. And wild bees are kind of chunky. Then flies, which is fascinating in the world of animals and insects, is they mimic the look of each other. And flies like to look like bees, because then maybe a bird or another animal won't try to eat them, because they look like they can sting when they can't. You can look at a fly and think, oh my gosh, look at this bee, because they look identical, yellow and black. But flies hover. if you've looked at a fly, it'll just raise up straight from a flower, whereas bees usually take off on an angle. They have no, they don't hover. So that's a pretty good way to tell the difference. And I'll have one more animal that is important. Well, there's butterflies also and beetles that are pollinators. So there's a lot of insects out there that are moving. They're feeding on nectar or eating the flower petals, but they're also eating the pollen. And while they do that, they're moving pollen around, but not as well as the bees.
That's great to bring up all those critters and then know who's good. And so as we're talking about this, Sue, I see we're both kind of looking at these beautiful guides that you have helped put together. Pollinator Activity Guide, Attracting Pollinators to Your Garden Using Native Plants. And this one that I really like, Native Wildflowers and Bees of Western Montana. So we have these great guides sitting here at this table, and I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about them, because they're great resources, beautifully done, and I would think that some folks listening to this In Other Words show would love to know where they can get these guides. So, yeah, how did they come about, and tell me a little bit more about what you have here.
As I said, I started from birds and went into bees and other insects, and of course I was starting from scratch, so I was hoping to talk about pollination and pollinators and the importance of native plants. And a lot of folks know a lot about native plants, but few folks know much about these pollinators. So in my role as an educator, I saw this gap in public knowledge about the pollinators. And so I kind of worked with a wonderful graphic designer, illustrator, Nancy Seiler, and she and I came up with this small booklet format, and we've put out now 3 different booklets on different aspects of the whole pollinator world. And we started with how to attract pollinators to your garden using native plants. So one of the things we have with wild native bees is they exist on native plants. And so I try to encourage people to plant native plants. They're best adapted to our climate. They don't need a lot of water. And native bees have evolved with native plants. And so it's a great relationship, because you know there's going to be healthy pollen and plenty of nectar for our pollinators with native plants. So that was fun, and that's how we got started in this whole what is pollination and who are the pollinators. Then after we did that, people were wondering what were our pollinators in more of a local level, because they wanted to go out and see for themselves. So we came up with using native plants and featuring a native pollinator we could find here in Western Montana. And so that was awfully fun. It's kind of big bees next to large flowers like Clarkia and a bumblebee species that would let people know what's out there. And then the last one we did last year was working on a guide for kids so that they could actually be used in a classroom or for folks who want to share with their children the fun of native bees and other pollinators, including butterflies and hummingbirds. So that's how these guides, and right now I'm working on a hummingbird guide. So it's been awfully fun, and I've learned a lot by having this focus of what are the local pollinators in this area.
That's wonderful, because people always think, well, native plants are great, but which ones and why? And it's so great to have some guidance. What I like about looking at these guides is you can see, oh my gosh, these flowers bloom early and these bloom in the middle, and we can basically can throw things around your yard or plant them so that you have stuff blooming all year round, and you get pollinators and activity, well, at least all summer long, maybe not all year. And there is this great little section in your guide, Planning Your Garden, Think Like a Pollinator. And it has all these things like bee diverse, BEE, that's pretty cute. So when I looked at this, that was great. Be a little messy, I'm good at that. Be bountiful, that is really good, because sometimes I just plant like one little native plant, and it's kind of better to do a patch of them and really get things rolling. This is a great little guide to what you can do. Be showy, be aware, be friendly, be sunny, be chemical free. I think these are really wonderful, and I will put some links on the inotherwordsradio.com website that we have, where we post both this show and also sometimes links to information that our guests speak to. And but if folks want to go about getting these guides and checking them out, Sue, where would they go for that?
Well, if you want to have one in the hand, a paper copy, you can come to the Lolo National Forest office out at Fort Missoula here in Missoula. But many of our other Forest Service districts and offices actually have copies too. So any of your Forest Service office and the Montana Natural History Center here in Missoula has copies also. We try to get them out as much as we can. They're being distributed at the farmers markets in Missoula, and that's a great audience because people are buying native plants and are interested. So also, as you said, we'll put it on. There is a website called Celebrating Wildflowers that's put out in actually from Washington, D.C., our national office. There's a big push. Surprisingly, when you think of the Forest Service, you may think of trees, which is a lot of what we do, but actually we're part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So there's a big interest in Department of Agriculture about the health of honeybees and also wild bees because they're so critically important to the food we eat. So it's also given me this great opportunity to do it as part of my day job besides my wonderful interest as an amateur naturalist.
So I'm speaking with Sue Real, and she is I don't even know if I'd call you amateur naturalist. She's quite a naturalist. She lives here in Missoula, Montana, and works for the Forest Service. And again, and in other words, radio.com, I'll post some links to, you can get these great pollinator guides. I wondered, Sue, if we could talk about a couple more things here. So we talked about a little bit birds, and maybe we can come back to hummingbirds a bit a little later, and bees, and how about bats? Because they're often talked about as pollinators. Do they do any pollinating?
So actually here in Montana, we most of our bat species are eating insects, but there are many species of bats in around Arizona and New Mexico, and then certainly south in the tropics that are important pollinators.
So one thing I was just reading a little bit about how bats, together with moths in some parts of the world, take over the pollinator night shift, and they at night come out and pollinate things like mangoes, bananas, guavas, and even agave, which is very essential for tequila. So we can't go without that. So bats are really important for pollination, but maybe not just here. It's great to find all these critters and to figure out who they are and to plant native plants. And in part because we're concerned about their populations of a lot of these that we know of. Anyway, there's a lot of threats to insects. We all know that. And I wondered if you could speak to a little bit of what comes to your mind when you think about some of the things going on that are of concern.
Well, I think everybody now today knows something about the collapse of the honeybee population in the last 5 to 7 years. And it's been kind of a mystery. The honeybees didn't make it through the winter a few years ago, and nobody knew why they had disappeared. And what we now think is they actually went out and died. But so that certainly had people alarmed because there's huge industry in honeybees and carting them from plantation or from orchard to orchard, and they're really important economically. So some research has been looking at what has happened, and of course there's, with any of these things, there's a lot of causes. It's never one exactly. There's no one cause. It's all interrelated. And if things are happening to honeybees, they're probably happening to wild bees also. And we have lost some populations of bumblebees that we know of, probably more than we don't even know about with other insects and other bees that are little studied. But so what we're finding is a couple of things. One of the bigger culprits is a pesticide that's systemically applied, which means it's put into the plant so that it's in all of the parts, even the pollen and the nectar. And that's where we think that it's a one pesticide in particular. It's neonicotinoids, which, like nicotine, actually jazzes up the insect and then it dies. And if it doesn't die, it is easily stressed by other things like weather and viruses. And so we're finding that the honeybees, and when they're doing their services, are picking up this pesticide. And people are aware of it now. It's outlawed in Europe, and it's on the radar. It just brings to mind that we always have to be really careful and find other ways to rid your garden or your lawn or your house from insects that are pests, because this can affect many other things too. And we are finding that if the insects are poisoned, we're seeing a little bit of an effect on birds too. So yeah, I recommend not using pesticides or insecticides in your garden if you hope to attract pollinators. The other thing that we don't know much about, but we're doing research on nationally, is the effects of climate change. If you are changing the flowering time of these plants, and then you hope that those pollinators are available to actually do pollination services. So once you start changing those conditions, it's going to affect the other animals that depend on them.
Yeah, I know at Audubon, there's been a big concern about hummingbirds being out of sync with the flowering plants. So there's a study down in Rocky Mountain National Park that looked at the broad-tailed hummingbird and glacier lilies, and the glacier lilies are blooming weeks earlier than they used to, but the hummingbirds are not arriving in sync with that bloom, and they're pretty concerned about that. There's such a little narrow window sometimes for birds, especially as they're migrating. They need their food source. I know, I was reading about hummingbirds. They're so wild. They weigh like, what, a penny, maybe a tiny bit more, and they have to eat 3 times their body weight every day in nectar. Two times. Thank you.
And they migrate thousands.
And I know, it's crazy. And so, you know, this program that Audubon started, Hummingbirds at Home, is trying to, one, learn more about when the hummingbirds are coming back, what they're feeding on, so that we can provide the native plants that they need in some places anyway to help with that migration and help them as they move through. And so there's a pretty neat link between a citizen science project and then something you can actually do, plant some native plants that maybe you didn't have in your garden, and at least learn more about where they are out in the, you know, more wild places and things. And I think that's a great project. I mean, I think about global warming affecting the timing and hummingbirds being out of sync with flowers, but, you know, that same story is going to repeat itself over and over again with our native bees and flowers and then the birds that eat the insects and all those complicated food webs we have out there. Maybe you could speak just a little bit more about ideas about what people can do.
Well, you mentioned that what we can do, citizen science, is awfully educational, but it's awfully fun too. I mean, I can spend hours watching hummingbirds in my garden. So, and with that, it's a great thing for us to do to actually try to provide these pollinators, bees, butterflies, beetles, and hummingbirds food. And that's by planting native plants and taking care of your garden and making it safe. That you need to keep your pets inside and you need to be careful with pesticides and herbicides. But we were talking about earlier, if you have a diversity of flowers, especially native plants, then you're going to attract a lot of really wonderful pollinators.
Not everybody has a big yard or a big garden. I always see opportunities for people to help get rid of invasive weeds in some of our local park areas or help plant plants along streams. And there's all kinds of opportunities out there to enhance that native plant population and then our pollinators. Sue, this is great to both learn from you and think more a little bit about birds, bees, pollinators, and things like that. And I just wonder if we could step back a little bit, because you have been involved in the Missoula community on all things nature and wild for a long time. And I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit more about what things you've been involved in Missoula.
Well, I won't go too far back. I did graduate from the University of Montana as a wildlife biologist and was lucky enough to get this wonderful job. But one of the things I learned early on is that there was just me and a lot of people out there that wanted information or classroom talks. And so early on with a group of people, we started the Montana Natural History Center because it was perfect to have folks in agencies and nonprofits have an organization devoted solely to education. So that was quite a I think, an exciting and wonderful opportunity, and it's been around for a couple of decades now, which is pretty fun. And I end up working a lot with them, as their capacity is huge with their staff and their connections to teachers and classrooms. And so it's allowed us to do a lot of really fun. We just had a pollinator education workshop for teachers last spring, and that was a great opportunity for us.
Well, I think folks that know Missoula or live anywhere near here know the Natural History Center is such a great asset to our community. So thanks for getting it going many years ago. So thank you so much, Sue Real. And I just, if you have anything else you'd like to add before we wind this down?
Well, one of the things I thought I'd mention, because it isn't always something that comes to mind with the gardening component here, is that you don't have to have any certain kind of plant, but you need to have a diversity of kinds of flowers. And sometimes these flowers are ones that you don't even think about. Things like willows and aspen actually produce some kinds of benefits to pollinators. They're often homes, and they'll have holes in them and it'll provide for housing. And then things that we don't often think about, like rabbit brush, which is a kind of a very hardy and underappreciated, and has fall flowers for a couple of months. So what you want to think about is making sure something's flowering every week in your garden, and you can get all kinds of different shrubs. Think about shrubs as much as you're thinking about a blanket flower or a penstemon, because that diversity is really important.
I've had rabbit brush up on my property, and I'm so amazed at the bees that it will collect in October when it's blooming. And then you said it's hardy. I don't know why mine died, but I'll have to figure that out. But too much what? No, I think it maybe voles. I think it got voles. Anyway, those little small mammals are not pollinators, and they think they dug around my rabbit brush. But that's a great one. And, you know, a couple years ago, I planted some golden currant because it blooms so early. And the hummingbirds have loved it. And now I have wax wings everywhere already just because of the berries that are produced. So it's been really fun to add a little every year, even though I can't do a lot. Well, so Sue, thank you so much for your work on helping us understand more about native bees and all pollinators. And I appreciate you being on In Other Words Radio.
Thank you, Amy. It's been a pleasure, and it's been fun talking to you about something I can talk about forever. So, thanks.
This is In Other Words Radio. I'm Amy Sillenberg with Montana Audubon, and I'm next going to speak a little with Amy Seaman, who is also with Montana Audubon. We're Team Amy, and Amy resides in Helena but manages to get herself all around the state looking for birds. Not so much bees or bats, mostly birds. So, Amy, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. So you are about to head out on a little expedition with your husband and another volunteer to search for the elusive black swift.
Indeed, we are. And I am so excited because I have never looked for a bird like this. And I'm going to learn a whole bunch of new techniques and probably get a pretty good workout hiking around Glacier. So, Amy, I know you've looked for black swifts more than most people. Can you tell me about what makes them so cool?
Well, yes. I actually haven't looked enough for black swift. I'm really jealous of you going up to Glacier. That's what I want to be doing this next week. But hopefully I'm going to get into the Mission Valley a little and look for them. They are the coolest bird. In fact, if you Google the coolest bird, what comes up is a big, long story about the black swift. They are cool because, so many reasons. They're completely insectivorous. They spend all of their day flying unless they're nesting, which actually they don't spend too much time at the nest. Where do they nest? They nest pretty much exclusively behind waterfalls in really steep terrain in the mountains. And they like to nest behind waterfalls because they lay just one egg, and that egg or that baby, that little nestling, is protected by the waterfall. So they're really in extreme places where no little predator can get in from the sides, from the top. Most predators don't, you know, get through waterfalls. The parents will lay this egg, incubate, but then once the nestling is hatched, they leave it there all day by itself on this little ledge, behind this waterfall while they go out and forage, and then they come back at night. Now, this makes finding this bird really hard because it's not flying back and forth to the nest to feed its young. It's just out, and it could be miles and miles away from these nests. We only know of 9 nesting areas in the state of Montana where these black swifts live, but we know there's some really neat waterfalls out there, plunging, cascading waterfalls, especially in Glacier National Park and in the Missions, where we think there could be more nesting black swifts. They're also cool. They fly really fast. We just learned within the last few years where they migrate to, down into the caves of Brazil. And that's new information. They're just such a little known. We know so little about these really cool birds. Swifts are, they look a little bit like swallows, but they're faster. They, again, are always airborne, even when they mate, which is obviously pretty cool. Think about that. And then the other reason that I really am interested in black swift is we are concerned about the future of the black swift. They have a really narrow nesting habitat niche. As birds that are completely insectivorous, they're really tied to insect populations. And if those become altered or shifted from global warming, they could potentially be out of sync with their food source. They also nest behind these, you know, glaciated streams in large part. And as glaciers recede, water systems change. We have less water in our mountain streams. There's a potential for those what seem like excellent nesting areas, if you're as bold and tough as a black swift, may no longer be appropriate places to nest. So the combination of changing water systems and potentially changing food systems does not bode well for the black swift. So that's why we need to know as much as we can about them, find out where they're nesting, and then, you know, go forth and tackle global warming. Thanks, Amy, for asking about the black swift, and I hope that you and everyone else gets to see one. Maybe not much of a pollinator, but a cool bird nonetheless. And now, in the last bit of this show, in other words, Amy is going to speak to a researcher about butterflies. Thanks, Amy, for this part of the show.
So today we have with us Jeff Pippin, all the way from North Carolina. So I'm going to have him introduce himself.
Hello, I'm Jeff Pippin, like Amy said, and I'm working here in Western Montana at the MPG Ranch looking at butterfly populations.
So what is so interesting about butterflies that it brings you all the way from North Carolina to spend the summer studying here?
Well, along with birds, bats, and other insects, butterflies are pollinators of various species of plants. And we can use butterflies as indicators for different phenomena that may or may not be happening, like climate change. We can look at changes in weather patterns to see how that might affect butterfly populations. We can use butterflies as models to test how our restoration efforts are working in a place like MPG Ranch, where a lot of their effort is put in toward restoring the habitats to functional ecosystems.
So concerning climate change, one thing Montana Audubon has come across is that changes in precipitation can have bigger effects on species than even the changes in climate that are expected as far as temperature goes. Do you know of any changes like that that may affect butterfly species?
Well, since precipitation affects plant growth and butterflies are dependent upon plants, a lot of the speculation about butterfly population fluctuations over the last several years has centered on precipitation and particularly droughts in Texas potentially affecting monarch populations and so forth during migration. So while I don't know of any formal studies underway looking at precipitation and butterflies, those factors are being considered when people are looking at long-term population changes in butterflies.
Weather can even affect how you see butterflies on a daily basis, and it seems that studying butterflies is much different than studying birds or bats, which are very early in the morning and then very late at night. What can you tell us about what it takes to have a good day in the field studying butterflies?
That's very true. And in fact, butterfly studying or butterfly watching, if you're interested as a hobby, just like bird watching, they kind of go hand in hand. They both are pretty. They both fly around. Birds are often most active in the morning, But then when bird activity starts to die down, butterfly activity starts to pick up. So you can do butterflies all day, and then you can do bats in the evening and just not bother to sleep at all. So butterflies are, since they're insects, they're cold-blooded, and they take heat from the environment. And so you really need warm, sunny days are best for looking at butterflies and butterfly activity. Of course, if it's too warm, then they can actually just kind of hang out in the shade or become less active. But temperatures that are generally above 70 degrees and below 100 degrees and at least partly sunny are great for doing butterfly studies.
So in addition to making a journey across the country to study butterflies in Montana, you've made quite a journey during your biological career. Can you tell us a little bit of your path and how you ended up studying butterflies?
So I was interested, or became interested in butterflies because I was already a birder. And I became interested in birds because I was originally interested in plants. My father was a botanist at Western Michigan University, and I grew up in Michigan. And I went to school at University of Michigan and in grad school in plant systematics, studying plants. I went to a field station in the summer where you usually take two courses. I went up there to take a course in plants and asked a bunch of folks what other course do they recommend. Everyone said take the bird class. And I said, birds? Sparrow, robin, cardinal, blue jay. I'm not getting up at 5 in the morning. No thanks. Enough people finally talked me into it that I took the bird class. And as they say, that sort of changed my life. Became a lifelong birder. And a good friend and mentor in North Carolina, where I was doing a lot of birding, and it was one of the best birders in the state, also was interested in butterflies. So we were out on birding trips, and he would point out butterflies. And I had taken an entomology class also at Michigan, and so that sort of set the stage. And then when he kept pointing out butterflies, eventually that kind of set the hook.
What would you say it is about studying butterflies that keeps you so excited and interested?
I think part of it is the concept of always, or the possibility of seeing something new. You know, just like with birding, you never know when an unusual species of butterfly may show up. In addition to that, there's a lot of questions that we still don't have answered about basic butterfly biology, behavior, and what's going on. And so I think there are a lot of things that we can look at in terms of host plant butterfly interactions, nectar butterfly interactions, even mutualisms between caterpillars of butterflies and ants. There's a number of species of butterflies whose caterpillars are tended and protected by ants. And there's a lot of things that we just don't know. Looking also at things like biogeography. If the host plant occurs in an area, why doesn't the butterfly occur there in situations where they don't? Or maybe we can predict where butterflies will occur in the future if they're not here now. Just looking at some basic questions like that, I think there's a lot we still don't understand and a lot of things that are interesting to look at.
Speaking of there being a lot out there, do you know anything about the number of butterflies in North America, in our region?
So butterfly diversity in North America, or at least in the United States and Canada, is somewhat similar overall to birds. There's probably about 800 species of butterflies in the U.S. A lot of those are right along the southern border when you get the tropical influence. In any given state, however, the number of species of butterflies is usually quite a bit less than the number of species of birds. Montana probably has around 200 species of butterflies, maybe a bit fewer. Missoula County has a butterfly list of around 130 species. That's pretty good diversity, and that's because we've got a good diversity of habitats, including mountains, the floodplains along the river, sagebrush, grasslands, dry, wet, high, low. And when you have a number of different habitats with different temperature and moisture regimes, you get a number of different kinds of plants, and different species of plants support different species of butterflies.
Is there one particular habitat that you favor for butterflying or that your favorite species tend to show up in?
Well, the high altitude meadows are pretty fun. Yeah, in the summer when it's pretty hot out, they're a little more comfortable. They're replete with wildflowers that are just gorgeous displays. And because you have a lot of native plant diversity, you often have a lot of really neat butterflies that go along with those habitats. So I do enjoy the openings in coniferous forests that are high up in the mountain meadows. Some great butterflies up there. So while there's approximately 800 species of butterflies that have been recorded in the U.S. and Canada, there are only six families, taxonomically speaking, of butterflies. And so it's pretty easy, if you want to get started looking at butterflies, to see something in your backyard and figure out what family it belongs to. And then from there, you can start identifying species. You know, the swallowtails are generally black and yellow and large. The whites and sulfurs is another family, and they're mostly small to medium-sized and whitish or orangish and yellowish and so forth. There's all six families are found in Montana, but one of those families, the metal marks, is restricted to just a few locations and is not very common this far north. That's a very large family in the tropics.
So we spent some time also talking about how it can be very difficult to identify female and juvenile hummingbirds. And, you know, sometimes you just have to leave an individual unknown and unidentified. Does that happen also in the butterfly world?
That's a great question. And I think in just about any world, when you're outside looking at things, you've got to be comfortable with yourself to be able to look at an individual something and say, that just doesn't fit into any of our human-constructed categories, and I'm going to leave it unidentified. With butterflies, when they first emerge from the chrysalis, they're fresh, they have all their scales, all their colors and patterns, but after a few days or weeks on the wing, birds can take chunks out of the wings. You know, they're hiding in vegetation at night, and that can wear the scales off, and so you get a lot of wear. And it can be very difficult to identify a worn individual. Often you just have to say, yeah, that's a skipper.
So that's good that you mentioned butterflies spending some time under vegetation. I've always been curious how they deal with some of the cold weather that we have here in Montana. Can you talk about some of their survival techniques?
Again, as cold-blooded insects, they take their warmth from the environment, so they're adapted to dealing with hot days and potentially cold nights. Butterfly activity at night is very limited, and on cold nights, most butterflies will just hide in vegetation, you know, under strips of bark on trees or in thick grass, and just wait until it's warm again. And sometimes that warmth may not come for 2 or 3 or 4 days later if it's cold, rainy spell comes through, and the butterflies can just stay physiologically inactive for several days, hiding until the weather conditions are right for them to emerge again.
Okay, so butterflies can handle a few days of cold. Can they handle our long Montana winters, or do all butterflies migrate?
Another great question. Different species of butterflies deal with winter differently, and some species that are found regularly in Montana, like the Painted Lady, cannot survive the winters here in any stage of their life cycle. And so every summer, whenever you see a painted lady, those have been repopulated from populations further south. So no painted ladies in any life cycle stage survive the winter. Other species of butterflies in Montana may overwinter as eggs or as caterpillars or as chrysalids. And even a few species overwinter as adults. It just depends on the species. The state butterfly of Montana, the mourning cloak, for example, overwinters as an adult. And they are able to produce a type of antifreeze in their blood to enable them to withstand very cold temperatures. And on warm winter days or when it starts to warm up in the spring, it's not unusual to see a mourning cloak out getting some exercise, taking some moisture, maybe some tree sap or some mud.
So overwintering as an egg seems like quite a feat. But also, how do you even find a butterfly egg?
Well, the best way to find a butterfly egg is to watch a female butterfly lay it. And then you inspect the leaf or the stem or the flower and look for this little dot. They're about the size of a pinhead, and they're usually pale. And some species of butterflies will lay them in the middle of a leaf. Some will lay at the tip of a leaf, Some will lay inside the flower heads or in inflorescence. So it depends on the species. And of course, most species of butterflies select certain species of plants to lay their eggs on. So if you start to learn which species of plants are used by the butterflies, that can help you in your searches.
So is there a short period of time in which butterflies will lay their eggs? I know often birds will raise more than one brood in the summer if they've been successful, you know, and the resources are available. Do butterflies ever reproduce more than once in a season?
This is also a species-specific phenomenon in butterflies. Some species of butterflies are multi-brooded, and you may see them when it starts to warm up in the spring and see them flying mostly all summer long into the fall. Other species of butterflies just complete their life cycle once a year, and so you may see them flying in the springtime only. The elfins are a good example of this. The western pine elfin, a really attractive, fairly small, brown but striped with burgundy and some other color patterns. Little butterfly has one brood in the springtime that flies through early summer, and then it's done for the year. Other species, lots of broods, or two or up to three broods.
So one butterfly species I think we're all familiar with is the monarch.
Montana is probably not known for a huge monarch population, but the species certainly does come through and use milkweeds that are growing across the state.
So I'm sure all of this talk about butterflies has gotten people really excited about seeing them in their own backyards. Do you have advice for attracting them to yards?
Finding butterflies in your backyard is a great thing to do and easy to do. A lot of butterflies are attracted to nectar, and so planting plants that produce nectar that attract butterflies is a great thing to do for your backyard. Using native plants generally is better than non-native plants. And along with planting nectar plants, if you really want to improve your yard habitat for butterflies, it's a good idea to plant some of the plants that they use, that the caterpillars use. So females will come in and lay eggs, and you can end up raising some caterpillars and some butterfly species in some parts of your yard, and then those adults will nectar on the flowers that you've planted in other parts of the yard.
I'm assuming then, since butterflies are insects, it's really important to pay attention to pesticide use.
Absolutely. Pesticides, if you need to use them in your garden, you would certainly want to follow the labeled directions carefully and then just limit their use to whenever it's absolutely needed.
Once we've gotten better at attracting butterflies to the yard and improved our identification skills, is there anywhere similar to eBird or any type of citizen science outlet to submit butterfly observations?
There are indeed several excellent online resources for citizen science projects looking at butterfly populations. There's a group called North American Butterfly Association, or NABA, and they have a Butterflies I've Seen, as well as, which is like eBird, as well as a recent sightings page. And if you join NABA, then you can contribute your sightings there, as well as getting a lot of great information about what appropriate nectar plants you may want to put in your yard and host plants and that kind of stuff. So lots of great information there. Another website is called BEMONA, which stands for Butterflies and Moths of North America. And that's a site where you can submit sightings, and those sightings, especially if you have photographs, and those sightings are vetted by experts and go into a national database. Additionally, a fairly new program being launched, it's patterned after eBird, is called appropriately eButterfly. And they're developing a national database of butterfly sightings as well. So there's plenty of resources where you can contribute to citizen science and to our understanding of butterfly populations and changes across the country.
And I'm glad you mentioned moths, because it's something I've failed to mention altogether. And I'm going to ask you that classic question. What is the major difference between butterflies and moths?
Well, both butterflies and moths are members of the insect order Lepidoptera. And Lepidoptera is Greek for scaled wings, because they have scales on their wings that give them the patterns and colors that we see. Butterflies and moths are different groups of the Lepidoptera and can be distinguished by a few generalizations. Generally speaking, butterflies are more colorful and active during the day. Moths are less colorful and active at night. There's a tremendous number of exceptions to that rule. So looking more carefully at the morphology, butterfly antennae have a knob or a club at the very end of the antennae. Moth antennae lack that knob and are whip-like or are feather-like. And butterfly antennae are never feather-like. Also, butterfly wings operate independently. All four wings operate independently. And so butterflies are more graceful flyers. Moths generally have their hind wing connected to their forewing, so they're less graceful flyers. And often I will tell people on a field trip, if they see, you know, a small to medium-sized orangish thing get up in the air and fly around, if it looks like it's flying with a purpose and it lands on a leaf or a flower with a purpose, it's probably a butterfly. If it looks like it gets up in the air going, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm doing, then it crash lands into the leaves or into the trees or the vegetation, that's probably a moth.
What are some techniques that you use to study butterflies?
I'm using three main methods for monitoring butterfly populations on the ranch. First is setting up transects. And on a transect, you walk a designated path once a week throughout the entire butterfly season, and you record to species level if you can, or to the closest taxonomic level that you're able to identify it, every individual butterfly that you see in a 5-meter radius as you're walking forward. That gives you a defined area, and you can do detectability studies, and it makes it a little more statistically robust for comparing populations or comparing numbers. In addition to these transects, I also study butterfly populations in some designated research plots, and I do timed surveys in those plots. Spend 21 minutes walking a zigzag pattern in each plot and seeing what the butterfly activity is. That allows me to see whatever resources that might be in that plot that might attract butterflies, whether it's nectar, flowers, or mud. Then, in addition to the transects and the plots, I do some general inventory work. And that allows me to go anywhere I want at any point and just see what butterflies may be out there that we're not finding in the transects and plots. That gives me additional time, too, to actually study some butterfly behavior. If I find some that are overpositing, determine which plant species they're using, and any other interesting plant-animal interactions that might be occurring here at MPG.
So when you're talking about watching butterfly behavior, what type of activities are you seeing?
In addition to determining which species of plants may be used for ovipositing, butterflies behave differently depending on the species. Some species will patrol gullies and washes. Other species are fond of going to hilltops. And in some species of butterflies, they will use the nearest mountain meadow or hilltop sort of as a singles bar. And the males will go up in the morning when it starts to warm up and cruise back and forth along the hilltop, and unmated females will go up to the hilltops searching for love. Another behavior that some species of butterflies exhibit is sort of a perch and chase territorial type of behavior almost, where the male butterflies will perch on a twig or a leaf and then chase anything that happens to fly or even walk by. If it's another male, a rival male, they may have a little dogfight trying to determine who's going to stay in that territory. And then if it's a female, then he's going to try to woo her into, you know, through some courtship behaviors.
Can you tell the difference between male and female butterflies?
Just like with birds, some sexual dimorphism is exhibited in species very strongly, and others it's very subtle. For example, in Steller's jay, you may have difficulty determining a male from a female. In butterflies, it depends on the species. So some of the swallowtails, for example, the males have a little more blue iridescence on the upper hind wings, somewhat subtle, but you can usually tell. In other species, it may be a case of looking at the shape of the tip of the abdomen or the abdomen in general, and the wing characteristics may not differ at all. Additionally, some species of butterflies, the males have special scent patches and use those for attracting females. And you can see those scent patches if you look in just the right place. So that's another difference between males and females that some butterflies exhibit.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for talking with us today and sharing your enthusiasm for butterflies. Definitely want to wish you good luck with the rest of your surveys, and hopefully we'll see you back in Montana next summer for more butterfly action.
Well, thank you, Amy. It's been my pleasure, and I hope a lot of people get interested in looking at butterflies and we make some new discoveries out there.
That's it for the In Other Birds, Bees, and Butterflies show on In Other Words Radio. Again, if you'd like to listen to this again or pass it along, you can do so via our website, inotherwordsradio.com. Thanks so much.